I think there's some different challenges that are heightened as a part of being remote. And then there's some other that are kind of not as big. It's still people. It's still a lot of the similar problems that you're going to have. You have ambitious folks. They want to grow. You have to provide ways for them to grow. You have to provide, you know, specific behaviors for them to opt into and demonstrate growth and demonstrate value. So those things don't necessarily change.
Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Brian Helmig. He is CTO and co-founder of Zapier. Welcome, Brian.
Well, thank you for having me, Jen. I'm very excited to be here.
I am excited to chat. I am a big fan of Zapier. I use it in my business. Definitely saves me some time and some worries. So I'm really looking forward to this chat. So let's start at the beginning about your role at Zapier. So what do you see as your mission as CTO? What does being CTO mean to you?
Yeah, so I kind of have like a dual sort of title thing going on where I'm CTO and co-founder, which is, I think, kind of a unique situation. And here in 2019, my role is kind of changing a little bit. We're, for context, we're about 210 or so people, about 70 of those are engineers. And we just recently hired a VP of engineering, so we're able to kind of like split that role. So I'm kind of going through this transition of formerly kind of wearing all the hats. So that meant people management and hiring and org design and you name it, as well as technical and architectural and product facing and customer facing. And now I'm able to split that a little bit. So I can talk a little bit about both sides of that divide. But on this side of the divide, I'm really excited. My role is going to be a lot more focused on the tech, on the product, on the cool stuff that we can be doing, on what customers are trying to accomplish with the product, and how is the technology accelerating that, and how is it maybe limiting it in different places. So that's kind of where my new focus is going to be, and I'm really excited about that.
Cool. So much more of a strategic focus as opposed to being in the weeds as much.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of everything. You know, one of the magical things about being a co-founder is you have a full range of the company. You can kind of hop into anything that really needs help, and you have the context, and you have the kind of social capital to really help teams out, and you have a lot of trust. So it's really about figuring out the best way to deploy that, I suppose, going forward. So maybe it's a team that's a little bit lost over here. Maybe it's a place that we really think is strategically important and we want to shore up that. Or maybe it's a difficult scaling problem, or it could be any one of those things. And hopefully I'll be able to hop in and really add a lot more, I guess, oomph to the effort, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I love that you use the word magical, that it's magical being a co-founder, both because you clearly love what it is that you do. I can definitely feel that. But also that trust is so huge, that when we build that trust and we have that in our teams, that so much more is possible there. And I can hear that's what's happening in Zapier.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm, you know, don't get me wrong, I love working directly on like the org and hiring and all that's so critically important. But I always came back to, I don't know, for me, it was like when you're in the shower and your mind is just getting geared up for the day, or you're unwinding or whatever, like where do those extra brain cycles go? And for me, it always went to the product. It always went to the tech. It always went to the architecture and the future and the things we could be doing with all of that. Though I still, you know, I look at the org design side, you know, for us, it's rolling out different career stages and different levels and things like that. That's all so, so important. But for whatever reason, my brain just doesn't attach to that stuff when it has extra cycles. So I think it'll be a really good like split and balance of having someone that can really go deep, who's like crazy passionate about that. Mm-hmm. And then I can kind of take on the other side. So very excited. This is a new thing for me in 2019. So we'll see how it goes.
That is very cool. It is very exciting. It sounds like you're really stepping into your zone of genius, or as one of my career coaching friends calls it, your zone of brilliance, that you really get to shine there. And whoever's VP or is in other roles is really going to get to shine in those roles as well. So that's super exciting. So let's talk a little bit about Zapier and the fact that it's remote. I was not aware that you guys are 100% remote. You had mentioned somewhere just over 200 people at this point, 210 people spread across lots of different countries, lots of different US states, but also spread across lots of different countries as well. And you didn't start out remote, correct?
We actually did start out remote. We were remote from the very first hire we had. So I suppose in the early days, we were a mix. It was whatever sort of worked. So it was Mike, Wade, and myself working nights and weekends, as you do in the early days. And when we could get together, we worked together, of course. But most of the times, we were just working from our kitchen tables individually. So that meant that a lot of the ways we were working and a lot of the muscle and traditions we were building were already fairly remote heavy, though we didn't really think of it that way. Really what set us down the remote path was, as soon as, you know, Wade, Mike, and I would be doing so much, and still to this day, we do a lot of customer support. In the early days, it was all of us spending our entire morning answering emails, and just, it was taking up a lot of our time. And that's a great connection to have in the early days. We didn't want to get rid of that, but we needed help. So the first person we wanted to hire is Micah. And he was in Chicago and we were out in the Bay Area at the time. And we had just moved out there for Y Combinator. And he was not going to move his whole family out to the Bay Area. We didn't think it made sense for him to necessarily do that. And we were looking at the next people we wanted to hire. We had James and we had Cooksey, who are also in Missouri, which is where we're all from. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to hire them next. And we were like, well, they're not going to want to move their families either. Maybe we should just do this remote thing. And at that time, I think it was 37 Signals was kind of pushing forward with this idea of remote. And we were inspired by that. We were sort of doing it a little bit already. So that was when we really decided, like, let's give this a good push on the remote side and see how it goes. And it's been awesome. It's been amazing. It caused us, especially in the early days, to think more critically about how you communicate and the processes and traditions you create, which I think if you're in a co-located company, you can kind of set that stuff aside because you get it automatically a little bit by just being in the same space as other folks. So we just had to be a little more purposeful earlier on. I don't think we solved entirely different problems. We just solved them maybe a little bit earlier, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So what would you say is the most amazing, most wonderful thing about being a 100% remote company?
Well, I think the most amazing thing by far are just the awesome people you can hire. We deeply believe that, talent is evenly distributed throughout the world, but opportunity isn't. Necessarily. And if you can do that, you can do good in the world and you can also work with amazing people and it's good business as well. So this is one of the amazing things is if we find some incredible Python developer in a small town in Ohio and he or she has been there their whole life, has a family there and doesn't want to move to New York or San Francisco, we can work with that person. It doesn't matter where you are. And to us, and that goes for in Thailand and maybe South Africa or maybe Barcelona or you name it, right? Like it's anybody, anywhere. And that without a doubt is like the coolest part. So it's the hiring side. It's the people you get to work with. And it's just the quality of those folks is really, really amazing.
Yeah, because you're casting a wider net, right? You're not just limited to one particular area. It's the whole world, really, and it's okay, who's the best person for this particular position, and it gives them that balance too, right? That it sounds like because you started the company based on we're not going to uproot families for this. We want families to stay intact. Was that kind of part of it as well in the initial thinking, and even now that the people who work for you, the people who are a member of the Zapier team, that having that balance is really, really important.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, especially in the early days, I don't think we thought about it as much as we do now, especially once we see the impact that, let's say, just removing your commute has from your life. Massive. That's, if you add it up, it's, I mean, hundreds of hours of your life just sitting there waiting to get somewhere that you could have spent with your family. You could be spending on your hobbies or doing anything really. That sorts of stuff is, or sort of hidden costs of having a co-located style of work. And, you know, nowadays, if you're doing knowledge work, if you're, you know, if you're creating artifacts that are entirely digital, it's insane to think that you need to be in an office with other people to do that work. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And I hear it a lot from people who believe that, oh, if I want to be a great, you know, insert job title here, if I want to be a great VP, if I want to be a great CTO, if I want to be a great software engineer, I need to be there in person, or maybe they borrowed this belief, or they've just heard it so many times from people that they think that that's the only way to make it work. But clearly it's not. And you guys are a great example of that.
Yeah, it's definitely not a requirement. And of course it depends on the company. So I definitely think that companies that have the tradition of being co-located, that's a difficult thing to uproot. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think you're best, if you're interested, and folks out there who might be like, you know, I love, you know, I'm in, this sounds great, remote kind of work. It makes sense. I'd be looking for companies that are entirely remote or are very purposeful about putting remote as like the first experience. Right. There's a lot of companies out there. I mean, we're one of them. There's the GitHub, GitLabs. There's Automatic. 37 Signals is this way. There's just a ton that have started to pop up, and it's showing that, yeah, you can do this. You can build significant companies doing really cool stuff in a remote way.
Yeah, and that's great advice for anyone out there who's looking for a remote job, that going to those companies who built it from the ground up that way, or at least 100% remote or mostly remote, because I don't know about you, but I've heard lots of horror stories about people who come on remote where the team is not 100% remote, and they end up getting the short end of the stick. They end up getting ignored, or it's just so much harder for them to have an impact because, oh, they're the remote one. We need to do a Zoom meeting for them now or whatever, when everybody else is, you know, not, when everybody else is there in person. So it's a really great advice, a way to think about it from a career planning perspective. I love that.
Yeah.
So I have a question, and you can let me know whether this is appropriate to ask or not, or whether you have the answer. But one of the things that I am often very curious about, and that I talk about a lot with my clients and the people who I work with, is salary, and thinking about setting salary expectations. And one of the things that I've always wondered, especially because salary is to some extent localized to particular markets, you know, it's just a fact that you're going to get paid more if you work in, you know, San Francisco Bay Area market versus, you know, middle of nowhere Idaho or something like that. The markets are different. So I've heard, you know, different approaches to this, but I'm wondering if you can share what your approach is, because you're 100% remote and it's around the world, what your approach is to sort of setting salary expectations and how you work that, given that you have people from all over the world working for you.
It's a really difficult question to answer because everybody's situation and skill level and everything is so personal, right? So that, you know, I'll start with that caveat. But we do think that whenever you're in different places with different cost of living, there's definitely a bit of a middle ground where a business can hire great, amazing, awesome people and not have to subsidize insane housing markets, like the Bay Area is a great example, right? Mm-hmm. And you can still have an amazing compensation that just blows out the cost of living in your area. So there's a wonderful middle point between even local comp and Bay Area comp that the rest of the world can really capture. And we found that this is something that's really special about remote work, because if you're in, I'll go back to, if you're in some small town in Ohio and you can get the same sort of comp that you might in, maybe not San Francisco, but let's say a big metro area like Chicago or Austin or something, that is just outsized, amazing comp compared to really struggling to make ends meet in San Francisco, where it's, you know, I think they said it was like $2,600 a month for a one bedroom studio, which is just crazy. So we look at that as like just being, you know, I think of it as like a great opportunity for both sides, right? Like you can get a great comp, the company can get kind of a great deal. It works out really, really well. So we found that that has been a super successful sort of pattern.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that. Cause I know it's something that people are curious about, but often don't know how to ask or who to ask. So I appreciate you sharing that. So the other thing that I'm curious about as far as being remote is essentially, okay, you've attracted all these great people in, they're superstars, they love it, you've given them this opportunity, and now what, right? So what have you found are, you know, some of the key strategies and principles that are really critical to leading and making sure that your team thrives, given that it's been high growth and 100% remote?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with just the folks we can hire as well. You know, we try really hard to make our values not feel like posters and feel like things you can really point to as behaviors. And you can, and once they're behaviors, you can ask behavioral questions when you hire and find the right folks that fit inside of your organization. And I'll just use one example. One of our values is default to action. This is really important in a remote environment. You might have something that you're not sure on, or maybe you're kind of blocked on, and maybe there's some other stuff you could do in the meantime, but you need to check in with somebody. And if you don't have that little spark of confidence, or that thing of like, you know, I'm just going to give it a try, we'll see, a little bit of forgiveness over permission sort of attitude, it's going to be, you're going to be stuck more often than other folks. So for us, I think it starts at hiring. We ask folks about times where they've been unsure, but they still found a way to go forward, right? And we listen to that story and look for the values that we kind of hold dear at Zapier. So I think it starts there. But we also have lots of traditions and lots of things inside of Zapier that help people navigate how they work. And, one example is learning when to raise the bandwidth on a conversation. And what I mean by that is we use Slack a lot, so a lot of conversations happen there, but often you'll be in a room and there'll be like five or six people all trying to talk at once, and you'll see that that infamous thing in Slack where they just stop showing the names of people who are typing. It's just as many people are typing.
Yeah.
When you see that, it might be a signal that you need to go to a video call. And in that case, we use Zoom often, and have that conversation real time where you can kind of resolve that, but also bring it back to Slack and summarize there. And that's really important. So it's learning all of these little tricks and these little traditions inside of your org that really help people navigate and communicate in that environment. And I think it comes natural to folks who've been in remote environments, but there's a learning curve involved in that. So if you don't have everyone practicing it consistently so people can learn it from each other and experience it working, especially, it can be a little bit challenging trying to do remote and be effective and grow fast.
Yeah, that's great. I love the default to action and when to raise the bandwidth of the conversation. And you had mentioned something earlier about really thinking critically about processes and how those processes are created. That sounds like it's a key to success here as well.
Definitely. And a great example is these same channels that you might raise bandwidth through are also more or less appropriate for different types of information to live. Slack is a great place for conversations, real time, ephemeral style things to happen. Zoom chats are a great place to get consensus and talk through and kind of explore something, but they aren't the right places to record decisions or record knowledge, right? So we often have people, let's say, record their Zoom calls and share those just in case someone's on the other side of the world, right? And they couldn't be at that meeting and they want to watch it and relive it and be a part of that conversation and recap later. But those things should move out of Slack, should move out of Zoom into some sort of documentation. And if it's an engineering thing, maybe it's in like a wiki or maybe it's in GitHub. We use Quip and Google Docs. Maybe it's there. We also built some custom internal tools, and these kind of look like, if you want to imagine what it is, it's like Reddit meets Twitter meets WordPress all in one. And this is where we call it async because it's for asynchronous communication. It's where people post their weekly updates of what they've done, what they've learned, what they reflected on. It's where we'll post results of maybe some tests and experiments we ran or some changes of, hey, here's something coming in the product, capture some conversation that was really interesting. And hey, here's the video link. You can go watch it. Or here's our quick summary so you can kind of get that TLDR as well. Yeah. So it's creating those different channels for the different styles of communication and then making sure you move to them depending on what you're trying to accomplish. And that's really important.
Yeah. And that is, it is so important. And I love that you're doing that and you're bringing this up because I think so many people are like, hey, yeah, Slack is awesome. And then you just kind of want to use Slack all the time or use Zoom all the time because it's the new hot piece of technology. And we're all, you know, tech geeks and we want to play with our toys. But at the end of the day, it's what's the best use for us for this team. And so it's great that this is a great example of being really mindful of letting the strategy come first and what is the purpose, have that come first and then decide what's the best tool for this, even to the point of building your own custom tool so that you can, you know, you can communicate more effectively with one another. So those are great, great examples.
Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to jenbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's jenbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview.
I have so many questions about remote, but I am mindful of our time and I have another question that I want to get to. But one other question related to the remote piece of it, Brian, is I'm curious how you deal with the time zone issue, especially because you have people around the world. So how do you work that? How does that work out when people are in different time zones?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're not perfect at it yet, but a lot of the strategies we use are similar to the communication, that bandwidth, getting to the right place around communication. So if this is something that needs to be communicated across your team or it's a decision, putting that into Slack and making that person that's going to wake up in 5 hours, right, scroll back through the Slack logs to understand what happened is a big anti-pattern. You don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So you want those decisions and those conversations to be digestible and summarized and easily accessed. So that's really important. We try to put teams together that have some overlap. In fact, it's sometimes optimal to have just a couple hours of overlapped for teams, especially engineers on a team. Once they're especially very independent and can start working, because it's less distracting at times. Like as an engineer myself, I love those quiet days. And sometimes on holidays across we have lots of different cultures, so lots of different holidays, and some days are a little quieter in Zapier, and I just find myself even being a lot more productive on those really quiet days. Mm-hmm. And if you can architect your organization around getting quiet time for certainly engineers that I was speaking about, that can be a really positive thing. And there's other places where time zones work really, really well, and we try to take advantage of those. A great example is when you're on call. So you have infrastructure, SRE folks who are on call. Well, if they can just be on call overnight, but it would be your, I guess, what you would call overnight, but is their day, that's a really, really awesome experience for the team, because now you don't have to wake up at 3 a.m. To handle some sort of alarm or alert. You have someone on the other side of the world who can handle that. So there's definitely some advantages. But you do have to be mindful about getting that time together, about organizing it, about making sure people don't get blocked, and that they can operate independently and autonomously. And coming back to that original value, default to action, where if they're not sure, they have the comfort and the security and the safety to make that call, make that guess, move forward, and not fear like any sort of why'd you do that sort of thing inside of Zapier. So we're very blameless to facilitate a lot of that, because if you didn't have that, you'd have a lot of people getting blocked with those time zones, and we have to work with them and not against them. So that's where we spend a lot of time thinking, is just organizing, structuring the org, I should say, to work with them.
Yeah, it's another great example of how the culture is guiding the decisions and the processes, and not the other way around. So, love that example. I wanted to ask you, Brian, about building an automation app and what drove you to do that. This is one of the cool things from my perspective of interviewing the person who's a CTO, but also a co-founder. You were there in the very, very early days, and I'm curious if there's a story behind why you decided to build an automation app. If there was something around, you know, the world needs more automation, we all need more free time, and let's help people to do this, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the original need was certainly, you know, Wade and I had worked together a little bit. We were doing some kind of side gig, side hustle things where we build a WordPress site and they'd want a forum on it, and then they'd want it to go to, you know, this client would want it to go to MailChimp and this one would want it to go to AWeber. And so we saw some of that pattern, and that kind of keyed us in on it. And that certainly was where a lot of this began. You know, we started with very minimal ambitions. We just wanted to make a piece of software that was valuable, and maybe we could support ourselves full time. And, you know, We got really fortunate, I'd say, in the early days, because we didn't pivot a lot from what we did in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. We just kind of honed in and built directly to user feedback from the very, very beginning. I remember our first 10 customers, I think, paid us $100 each to validate that we were building something they would value. And of course, the integrations that they wanted, they didn't exist yet. So a lot of times they'd be like, so Wade would say, hey, we got another customer. They want to connect this to that. Can we build that? Yep, we'll have it ready tomorrow, you know, kind of a thing. And that was a really healthy way to respond super fast to customers and find that signal. So that's where, you know, the initial seed came from and how it grew into what it is today. But now that we have a lot more legs on what we're doing, and we've been really fortunate over the years, we kind of look at like, what was the underpinnings of why it was successful? And mm-hmm. I think really what it boils down to is I think you see this with just tech in general. It used to be, you know, two decades ago, if you wanted to start a web company or a tech company, you had to buy all the gear and find a colo place. And it was super capital intensive and very difficult. And now you can just rent servers from AWS for a couple bucks a month, and away you go. And you amortize that cost over a bunch of people and over time. And we're seeing something sort of similar happen here, where in the past, if you wanted to automate stuff, it's like, well, you had to hire a bunch of engineers and a bunch of developers to do that and to figure out how to manage them and do all this other stuff. And that restricted the, I would say, the penetration of things like automation to folks who had the capital and had the resources to do it. And nowadays, you can kind of do the same things with Zapier. You can, with clicking a couple buttons, say, hey, when I get a new lead over here, if it matches this, also send it over here and add this tag to it. And if it says this and it's a high deal, immediately send an SMS to my sales. Like, you can do all this amazing stuff. And that is really valuable, but it's accessible now. It's something that anyone can do for, 20, 30, 40 bucks a month. You can have this plan that can do all this amazing stuff. And before, that was, tens of thousands of dollars of development cost. That's a huge, huge difference. And I think that is kind of the underpinning of why these sorts of things, the democratization of automation, is really happening today.
Yeah. And I certainly, as a business owner, a small, very small business owner, I'm not small, my business is, very, very grateful for that. Because if apps like yours didn't exist, I don't know. I don't know what I'd do, honestly. Like one option would be to hire a developer to do it for me, right? To build something custom. And you're right, that's tens of thousands of dollars, which is capital that a lot of small businesses don't have or can't justify paying that much for. All I want to do is that when the credit card transactions goes through, I want them to get an email so it's automated,
Right.
And so that's why it's really nice to have Zapier. It's how I use it, in my business. It's mostly for, client onboarding, that as soon as they're in, as soon as the credit card transaction goes through, boom, they get an email and my VA gets notified that, and then she emails them and connects with them. So it's like, wow, this happened automatically. I'm in, as opposed to, them having to wait a few days. Okay, I just gave you my money. Where's my stuff? Is this for real? It's that, it's part of that social proof that, yep, we're for real and we're going to do this and we're going to help you. So that's certainly how I use it and how it helps our business. And that there's just more of a need for this because there's like so many different apps. And what are we going to do? Tie them together with Silly String? And it's almost right. Like Zapier is a really great way to do that. And you don't have to know how to code, which is good for me. Because I don't.
100%. Yeah, and it's not just small and medium business certainly that are able to do interesting things. I think of even just like the individual inside of the larger org that is thinking like, oh, it would be so nice if this piece of software that I have to use could do X or could do Y, and either you have to convince someone to add that feature or build that out, or now you can kind of be a little bit of an army of one and kind of go off and do some of these things. And it's cheap enough that you can expense it, or maybe your team already has it and you can just hop on the account and start using it. And, for me, like I do stuff like I'm in meetings all the time. I'm like doing podcasts, I'm doing hiring interviews, you name it. And my availability is really spotty. So I have Zap set up that trigger whenever Google Calendar events are coming up or ending. Because I live in Google Calendar, but all my team lives in Slack. So I update my status in Slack. So everybody knows like, oh, Brian's chatting with Jen on the podcast, or Brian's doing this, or Brian's doing that. So they know my availability as a result. And that's something that didn't exist. And Google is certainly not going to build that for me. And it's not worth me sitting down and writing all of this like complex code to literally get that little feature that helps the team a little bit, but isn't like make or break, but in aggregate is super, super valuable to me. Those sorts of things are kind of the little cracks that Zapier is kind of putty and fills in and makes you just more productive and your team more productive. And that's, you can't underestimate those sorts of things because they build up over time and they're really, really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have other favorite Zaps? So it sounds like one of them is, I want to make sure I understand this. So we're going to get a little into the weeds here, but I think my audience is absolutely going to appreciate this. It sounds like it's essentially, if you're, it's a calendar item, like a Google Calendar item connected with Slack, with a Slack status update.
That's correct. Yeah. So basically, as soon as a meeting starts, I have a trigger that meeting starts or meeting ends. and it just updates my Slack status automatically. So all day long, you'll see my status changing. Like it'll say I'm in this meeting, or I'm available, or I'm doing this. All day long, it's just swapping around. That way, anybody on the team can just see my status, and they don't have to go and, you know, turn on or find my calendar or see what my availability. They just know that I'm either available, or I might take a minute to respond, or I'm doing something. So that's really, really useful. You know, we spend a lot of time in Slack, so it's not just stuff like that, but like I will star messages and send myself an email. It's a trigger of star message in Slack, an action of send myself an email, and it'll get automatically categorized in my to-do inside of Gmail. And since I mostly work out of Slack or out of Gmail, I never really fell in love with any to-do apps. Mm-hmm. That's just a more natural place for me to live and to get my stuff. So a classic example is someone will ping me in a Slack room. I'm like running around. I don't have quite a time to handle that right now, so I'll just star it real quick. And then now every time I go into my inbox, I have that reminder of that little bit of work that I could be doing. So those are just those little things that, you know, you stack up and you get a couple dozen of these little robots running around your company, making everybody a lot more productive. And yeah, it just is, it's really powerful. And it's really empowering too, because you can iterate on these and you can say, well, actually, maybe I want this email to go to the person that is that I want help with. And now you can tweak this app to send that email off to someone else or CC someone, or mm-hmm. you can say, oh, actually, I don't want it to be star. I want anyone to be able to do this. And now if someone adds a specific emoji inside of Slack, you go do, you know, you can start to like really play around and expand these use cases to fit whatever you or your team needs. And that's, I mean, that's really powerful. You become kind of your own puppet master, so to say.
Yeah, that's very cool. And it's a great point about it being empowering. This is not just about saving time, although that's huge. I mean, even if it just did that, that would be awesome. It's empowering because it's, what does that now mean I have more time to spend on, and I'm less frazzled, and I'm feeling, you know, more confident, and I have more energy. It's amazing what a little app like that can do. It's not such a little app. So that's really awesome. It absolutely is empowering. I could not agree with that more. One more question about Zapier, the company, and what you guys do, and then we'll end with the last question. But I'm curious, and I'm not even sure how to ask this. It's kind of an off-the-cuff question. But like, so for example, you know, you have Zaps that are like Slack to Gmail. Do you need to contact the folks at Slack to get permission to do this? Like, what's the process there? Or is it just a matter of, is there something else that needs to happen there?
Yeah, so we do have a lot of relationships with some of these partners, because we do a lot of cool stuff and we help their sales team, you know, close deals so they can say, yeah, we work with this, go check out Zapier. Or we help their support folks who often have questions and we can add some of this. So we do have those relationships. But the really amazing thing about Zapier is we kind of are relying a lot on some of the open ecosystems that have popped up around APIs. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of cases, there's things that we ourselves work on those integrations and build them out. Google is a great example. Google's really, really popular. They got a great ecosystem. So we've built out a lot of those integrations ourselves, and we manage them. But a lot of the other apps out there, they have their own ecosystems, and we wanted to serve them as well. But I think today we have 1,400 or so apps on Zapier, but we can't build and manage every single one. So what we did is we opened up our own ecosystem and platform. So any partner can come along and build an app on Zapier today, and you just install like a Node.js package and export a couple little functions and tell us how to get data from your API. Mm-hmm. And it automatically interoperates with anything else that we have inside of Zapier. So those've been multiple ways we've kind of approached that in the past, both building relationships with some of these larger, you know, marquee brands out there, like the Googles and the Slacks and things like that, but also allowing all of smaller and medium-sized companies to get on the platform as well. So it's not just the big companies that are here that we work with. We have a ton. And both of those strategies are a big part of how we build those integrations inside of Zapier.
Yeah, and that's great. And you had mentioned earlier about that it can be a selling point, and that your company works with Zapier, I can build a Zap. And that's been the case with me when I've been looking around and kind of looking at different, whether it's a CRM or, you know, a learning management system or something like that, you know, like, so for example, we use Teachable. And when I was looking at what LMS do I want to use, and I saw Teachable, and then I saw, oh, and I can build Zaps from Teachable to other stuff like my CRM, like that's it, you know?
Right.
And so that's cool that for the smaller companies that may not have their big, huge ecosystem, all the resources to do it, that it's really just, okay, hey, you can get on the platform. That's really cool.
Yeah. And I mean, especially in those cases, you can build that integration once, and certainly, like I said, the big ones we manage, we have a lot of folks on the team that are monitoring these APIs. So, you know, when Teachable integrates with Zapier, they just keep their one thing working and we take care of the rest, right? We take care of all the connections, and it's all the other partners, like we're keeping an eye on all of that. So they don't have to build 30, 40, 50, 100, 1,000 integrations. They just build one and we kind of like manage all the, you know, 99 or 999, however you want to think of it, rest of those. And it's much more effective for sure.
Excellent. All right, Brian. So we're coming up on time. We have about 5 or 10 minutes left. And in that time, I want to ask you the last question. And this is the question that I ask all of my podcast guests. And it is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Yeah, I think back to some of the earlier conversations we were having where, you know, for us, the unique thing is we're remote. So I think there's some different challenges that are heightened as a part of being remote. And then there's some other that are kind of not as big. You know, I chuckle because I remember when I was learning to become a manager, we used this great podcast called, I think it's called Manager Tools. And they had all this great, awesome, just really obvious, but super helpful guides on becoming a manager. And there were some of those that were super relevant for us, like how to, you know, facilitate communication, and grow people. But there's also some that didn't, that weren't a part of it, like how to approach awkward conversations like body odor issues or something like that. That's not a part of our, we don't have to worry about that. So that's really fun. But the really interesting thing is it's still people. It's still a lot of the similar problems that you're going to have. You have ambitious folks, they want to grow. You have to provide ways for them to grow. You have to provide, you know, specific behaviors for them to opt into and demonstrate growth and demonstrate value. So those things don't necessarily change. The biggest people-related challenge is probably more along the lines of making sure people have, or I should say, assume positive intent in some of these more lossy mediums. I don't know how many people have done someone not text you back or text back K or anything like that. And you kind of, your brain just goes to, huh, that was a bit curt, or that didn't feel good. Like you bringing that into a regular part of your communication in a professional environment can be a little bit tricky. So you have to teach people on both sides to really be thoughtful about how they communicate and be really thoughtful about how they write in those text communications, but also on the flip side, not read into anything in text communications that isn't there, certainly, because that's such a, you know, ground-based reality of a remote company, is that so much information is going over text. So if you don't assume that positive intent, if you don't, you know, remember that we're all on the same team, it's easy to get, it's easy to sometimes feel maybe you're not appreciated, or maybe that person didn't really think through what they were saying, or something like that, when in reality, it might just be the limitations of text. So you always have to follow up and get clarity, like, oh, it sounded like maybe you weren't interested in this, or and get clarity on that rather than making kind of assumptions. That's certainly been a big part of being remote. And it takes a little bit of practice, but once you get to the other side of it, it's also really, really healthy to just be able to interact with that. Just assuming a positive intent from everyone around you, it just feels a lot better once you kind of get that into your habits.
Yeah, and it takes a really strong culture to trust that. I could imagine that for new folks, assuming that positive intent, okay, I hear you, I'll do it, but gosh, like I don't know these people yet. I haven't really gotten a sense of who they are and what they do and what can I expect from that. So there's probably, I would imagine, a bit of a learning curve there, not just from using the technology and the communication, but also that, okay, I will assume positive intent. It's my mantra. I will assume positive intent.
Right.
Even though, because I think we've all been there, like the K, yeah, K, that's not even a word. You know?
Right.
What does that mean? I mean, we've all like, oh, especially if we're having a bad day, we can tell ourselves all these stories about what this person said when really it was just, okay, I'll do it. All it takes is
right.
A question. What did you mean by that? Does that mean you'll do it? Does that mean you understand? Does that mean you agree?
Yep.
Yeah.
100%. And it is tricky. And we have lots of like training, and we talk about this, and we watch for this because we've seen it happen a few times. So we're really thoughtful and purposeful about that. But we also do twice a year, we do get everybody together. So it is really nice to get everyone together. So you have that more intimate connection of seeing someone, being around them, to lean back on in those moments. So you're like, so for example, if Scott says K to me, I'm like, oh, I know Scott. Like we played a board game together at the last retreat. He's a genuinely nice person. I know that for sure. So it really helps cover some of that as well. So that plus all the training, plus being really specific about how we approach it, it does help in the end. But it's something we watch out for, especially in the early days.
So there is specific training around communication.
Yeah, definitely. And it's often about what we talked about earlier, too, about when do you raise that bandwidth. That might be a good place to do that, if you felt like someone maybe didn't understand or maybe seemed a bit skeptical about something that you believe really strongly, seek that clarity, maybe raise that bandwidth. Like that's all part of the kind of communication training that we try to give folks who join in, because so much of our communication happens digitally that if you don't spend the time on that, you miss a big opportunity for making people work together a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you have in-person retreats as well.
Yeah, we do that twice a year. And they're getting bigger and bigger. They're really fun. I think there's something special about getting everyone together when that isn't the default mode, because the energy level is so high. Everyone's so excited to see each other and spend time together. Whereas like when you're in an office, that's just kind of the baseline. So it's down a little bit, right? This is a long-term sort of thing. So you do see some really cool stuff happening in those retreats, and there's something to lean back on for the rest of the year. So you have those real like human connections with folks, which is really, really important. But everybody still gets to go back, spend all their time with their family, spend all that time doing what they love to do and having a good work-life balance. That's really important as well. So you get the best of both worlds, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking of it. You can have your cake and eat it too, and all of the icing and all of the sprinkles on top. But it takes careful planning, and it takes being really mindful of this is our environment and we're building a culture. And leaders such as yourself who are actively building that culture and communicating, this is what we do, you know, assume positive intent, and that do you need to raise the bandwidth of this conversation, and go take action. Don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness later. All of these things kind of come together. So such a wonderful, wonderful way of thinking about building a company, and such a wonderful example of this is happening. So really, really appreciate talking with you today, Brian. Thank you so much for sharing everything.
Of course. Thank you so much, Jen. Thanks for having me and appreciate your time too.
Yeah, thanks. All right. So I am going to stop recording.